This is Sonny Bailey from the New Zealand Wealth and Risk podcast and, of course, the New Zealand Wealth and Risk blog. Now, it's been a while since I published on this podcast, but it's something that throughout 2018 I'm hoping to become a lot more regular at. Podcasting is a medium that I myself really love. I'm subscribed to... Actually, I don't even want to admit how many podcasts I'm subscribed to and the backlog that I want to listen to. I've actually taken to listening to podcasts at 2 speed. Don't hold that against me, but I can't even listen to them at normal speed anymore. But to each their own. Today I want to talk about conflicts of interest, and I'm going to start with an anecdote from my university years. When I was at university, I lived in quite a few different flats, and in a lot of those flats, we'd have an arrangement where one person would cook for everyone else in the flat on a given day or days throughout the week. And a common policy throughout all of those flats is that the person who cooked the meal on that night was also the person who did the dishes. Now, arguably, you could say it might have been better for somebody else to do it, because that person had already cooked that day and had spent a lot of time, and maybe it would be a good idea to give them a break for the rest of the evening. But what we found is that if the person who cooked also did the dishes, they tended to use less dishes. And that created, I guess, an incentive for them not to create more dishes than was necessary. And it's one of those kind of personal anecdotes or examples where there was kind of a conflict of interest going on, and that was just the best way of managing that conflict of interest. Now, conflicts, it's something I've become super sensitive to in my professional life. Conflicts of interest relate to where the interests or incentives of one person or group of people conflicts with the interests of another group or people. And before I talk about it in any more detail, I just want to get it out of the way that I do believe that incentives matter. Incentives motivate behavior for better and for worse. Now, one interesting observation I have is that the people often believe the same thing, except when it relates to them in their own context, especially their professional context. It's a funny one. I think to a large degree it's rubbish. That's kind of what I'm getting at here. The fact that incentives matter, on a side note, it's one of the reasons that the regulation is important. It's easy to have kind of a knee-jerk reaction to say that regulation is bad, it's kind of getting in the way of the free market, etc. But effective regulation actually makes the market more perfect. So I believe in the benefits of the free market and capitalism, but I also understand that the perfect market that they talk about in economics 101 courses does not exist in the real world. There are issues with it, and they do need to be addressed. Now, regulations can actually make the market more perfect. So, for example, there's a lot of consumer protection legislation that makes it illegal for people to mislead or deceive. If there was no legal prohibition against lying, then I can guarantee there'd be more of it, and you could say that there'd be less perfect information, one of the criteria for a perfect market and getting optimal outcomes that you read about in the Econ 101 textbooks. Regulations can also stop people from ignoring externalities too. So externalities are the effects of a transaction that impact people other than the people strictly involved in the transaction. A clear example is pollution. So if there's no incentive for a polluter to factor in the cost of their pollution to other people that they don't charge or they don't deal directly with, then regulation, when effectively done and enforced, can be quite effective. Now, stepping back at a societal level, I mean, a lot of these situations, it's like we're living in a big prisoner's dilemma, to borrow the example from game theory, where the dominant strategy for ourselves might work for us as individuals, but the optimal strategy for everyone, including for ourselves if everyone cooperated, leads to the most benefit for all. So dealing with each other requires cooperation, and effective regulations are a really terrific example of that coordination. one of the best articles I've read that addresses this really hard issue of coordination. It's titled Meditations on Moloch. It's by an author called Scott Alexander, who runs a blog called Slate Star Codex. It's a really fascinating blog. I'll link to it in the notes. But I guess all of this is an aside. It's not really the key point that I want to make in this podcast. I see conflicts of interest everywhere now, but I'm especially sensitive to it where I have a professional background, which is in financial services. So I'm going to discuss some conflicts of interest which can influence behaviour. And I'm not saying that this is always the case, but there are definitely incentives which can influence behaviour, and it's certainly the case that in some cases they do. ASIC is the Australian regulator of financial services providers, including advisors, has released a lot of reports over the years indicating that there are loads of problems with financial advice. There can and there has been loads of problems where there is vertical alignment, which is really just a fancy way of saying where the financial advisors in question are affiliated with the product manufacturers, often banks. I'm probably being a little bit blunt here, but in practice it does seem that banks can use financial advisors as a mechanism for distributing their products. Again, I'm super conscious of all this, and I'm trying to make my business as clean as possible based on this awareness of conflicts. Now, one of the most common ways of managing conflicts of interest that I could do will be to simply disclose them, let clients know what the conflicts of interest are, let them factor that into the advice, whether to follow it, and leave it at that. And that would probably be the most commercially beneficial for me, but I don't think it's very effective. There's a terrific title, terrific article from 2009, and it's called The Dirt on Coming Clean, Perverse Effects of Disclosing Conflicts of Interest, by three authors at really reputable universities in the US, Dalen Kane, George Lowenstein, and Don Moore. It's so good, I'll quote the abstract in full. Starts off strong. Conflicts of interest can lead experts to give biased and corrupt advice. Although disclosure is often proposed as a potential solution to these problems, we show that it can have perverse effects. First, people generally do not discount advice from biased advisors as much as they should, even when advisors' conflicts of interest are honestly disclosed. Second, disclosure can increase the bias in advice because it leads advisors to feel morally licensed and strategically encouraged to exaggerate their advice even further. So this means that while disclosure may insufficiently warn an audience to discount an expert opinion, disclosure might also lead the expert to alter their opinion of it and alter it in such a way as to overcompensate for any discounting that might occur. As a result, disclosure may fail to solve problems created by conflicts of interest, and here's the kicker, it may sometimes even make matters worse. So, people who disclose conflicts of interest often cause people receiving the advice to trust the person who disclosed that even more, and the person who disclosed it almost feels like they've got a moral license to take advantage of the conflict. Now, I'm trying to build my understanding of all of these things into the DNA of my own business, Fairhaven Wealth, in terms of the business models and everything. And so I guess this is one of the things that informs my view of the world and how Fairhaven runs. So I'm prioritizing a number of things. One is independence. Now, independence from product manufacturers like banks or managed investment scheme managers. I'm not linked to any provider. I have total freedom in terms of who I recommend. I've got no pressures whatsoever. I want to be able to talk when I advise clients and even talk in general, for example, on my blog, without fear or favour. And I put that into practice even recently. Like, I mean, one of the managers that I'm especially fond of at the moment that I really like is Simplicity. I did write an article fairly recently saying that guaranteed income funds can't provide you certainty. I think I still say a lot of positive things about that product, and like I say in it, there probably are clients where I would consider recommending that product offering. But I'm also very keen to make it clear what the risks and potential issues with any product are. So as much goodwill as I have towards any given manager, I am going to say what I believe is the right thing to say. There are plenty of other articles in my blog where I've said even more things about products and product issuers. Probably the most notable one is my one about bonus bonds. I don't know whether to be impressed by the business model or appalled in terms of client outcomes. Another way of being independent is that I'm not affiliated with brokerage service providers. There's some fairly prominent financial advice businesses that you couldn't really say that they were product issuers, but they are brokerage service providers. And what that means is there are actually incentives for them to encourage clients to trade, because, again, that creates revenue for them. That sort of incentive can compromise the advice. So, again, nothing of that sort. I'm making a firm rule on those sorts of things. Some bank advisors in New Zealand say they're independent because their bank doesn't actually have a platform or investment products. And that's a degree of independence. But the bank still has other products which their clients can borrow money from the bank, mortgage facilities, etc. I do wonder how many banks are actually going to be happy if their advisors are telling their clients to just pay off their mortgages rather than invest, or that counselling clients that they really shouldn't be borrowing more than they otherwise might. Another factor that can create conflicts of interest is fees. I mean, the straight up first thing is commission. That's a no-no for me. It's possible, and I've seen a lot of advisors that do receive commission to provide really high quality advice, but it creates incentive to sell products. No two ways about it. There are instances where you do see, I guess, sales spiels masquerading as advice, and I want to steer as clear away from that potential as possible. The other absurd thing is, especially in relation to insurance, commission can actually create disincentives to provide appropriate advice. So, for example, there are loads of clients where the best thing they could do is to actually reduce cover and reduce the premiums they pay. I'd almost say that about half of my clients, I've been saying that. Now, if I were receiving commission, like an ongoing commission in relation to those products, I would end up being in a scenario where I'm actually providing the best service I can to the client, but by encouraging them to reduce their premiums, I'm reducing my income. How does that work in terms of aligning my interests with providing the best service with clients? One really common way that often independent and fee-based advisors charge investment advisors specifically is asset-based fees. That can create conflicts as well. That creates a bias towards investment products, because asset-based fees are usually charged as a percentage of a client's investment portfolio. That, again, means that, at least from a remuneration perspective, it's more attractive for an advisor to be working with a client with a lot of financial assets as opposed to other assets, which might be assets within privately held companies or direct real estate. It also can create an incentive for wanting clients to invest in financial assets when the smartest thing or the most appropriate thing for a client, given their circumstances, needs, objectives, etc., would be to just repay debt. But repay debt is not something that you'll receive income from if you're receiving asset-based fees. It also creates a bias against spending money. Some clients are doing particularly well And the best thing that they could do from a lifestyle perspective, and I'm not judging, this is based on, you know, their personal values and priorities, it might actually be to take $500,000 out and buy that new Ferrari. But if I were charging asset-based fees, $500,000 less in their portfolio might mean $5,000 less income per year for me, and that's got to sting. It's got to hurt. And might have an influence on the advice that I'd be inclined to give the client. Look, even hourly-based and fixed-fee remuneration structures, they create conflicts. You could say that hourly-based fees encourage people to spend more time on a matter than they otherwise would. You could say fixed-fee might even encourage people to spend less time because they're just going to get the same amount. But I think on net, those are probably the most aligned forms of remuneration, and I think that's why you'll often see hourly rates or fixed fee rates used by what are often considered the professions, whether that's law or accounting or medicine or dentistry. So, I mean, I guess in a few ways in this particular podcast, I'm just thinking out loud. These are some of the thoughts that influence Fairhaven Wealth's business model and some of the decisions about the business. There's some of the thoughts that have kind of influenced the way I perceive the financial advice industry. It's influenced a lot of the things that I do. So, for example, I provide, I only charge fixed fee. I provide an advice-only service as opposed to insisting on implementing and insisting on engaging clients on an ongoing basis, which can be good, but it does reduce options for clients where that might not be appropriate. Ultimately, I want my focus to be on clients and client outcomes. I want that to be a part of the DNA of Fairhaven Wealth, even if that's not necessarily in my best interests myself, at least in the short term. I think if I'm providing the advice, the best possible advice I can be over the long run, that's the smartest and most self-interested things that I can do. Conflicts of interest are one of those challenges that we all face. In some ways, we don't just face them from external pressures. We can actually experience them internally as well. Quite often, we act in our own best interests sometimes. There's a terrific term for it called acrasia, where it's almost like we act against our own best interests, or present Sunny, for example, might not be acting for the benefit of future Sunny. And there are all sorts of strategies you can try and work to address that. Good example is, you know, I find, just like most people, that it's not easy to eat as well as I might like to, especially when those chocolate biscuits are right there in the cupboard, easily accessible, easy to eat. So my general philosophy in life and in business in relation to these situations is that it's much easier to avoid temptation than to resist it. It's why I try not to have chocolate in the house that's easily accessible. It's why I run my business in a way so that I don't have any temptation to provide advice that's not in my client's best interests. Thanks for listening, and continue to stay subscribed to the podcast. If you're not subscribed to my mailing list, I really encourage you to do that. The New Zealand Wealth and Risk mailing list, so you'll receive access to a PDF copy of my book, Simple Tips for Savvy Kiwis. You'll also receive a series of emails explaining how to build your own financial plan. Thanks, and if there's anything you'd like to hear on the podcast or on the blog, drop me a line, let me know. You've been listening to Sunny Bailey of the New Zealand Wealth and Risk Podcast.